Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Gavin, how are you, mate?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right. Good. All things considered, I'm doing all right. where are you now, and where should you be now in the alternate reality that would have been?
I would have been somewhere in Europe. I would have just got to Sardinia after a European tour that blew everyone's mind.
Obviously.
So I had a chance to go to. I like to take my boys, give them a bit of Europe. You know, go on holiday with my friends. And we have this sort of, you know, nice thing where work really hard and then, like, got to take the kids somewhere. So I take, my three best friends with me. And we were going to this crazy place in Sardinia. So there you go. There you go. But I haven't thought about it that much. It's more like I'm excited about having the record coming out. And, you know, some people are, like, seriously suffering out there that it's just like you can't. Do you know what I mean? If that's your biggest loss, then you're doing more than all right. So,
yeah,
I'm all right with it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I think as well, if you're a creative person and you make a living out of thinking on your feet and making something out of nothing by default, you're quite adaptable and used to rolling with the punches. And I think everybody who's in this field of work, no matter how successful you are now, you were once a struggling artist. So it's no surprise to your psyche to kind of be thrown and have obstacles that you've got to work around and overcome. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, my whole life is about obstacles, as you point out, for sure. And we have to turn on a sixpence or whatever you call it, whatever the phrase is, and we have to make it adapt and change. And you know, the fact that I've had such a long career is a testament to the fact that I completely understand that and completely... I'm always ready and pretty much. I don't like change. There is nothing but change. So we deal with it.
That's all life is, right? Is the great unknown. We just sort of make it up as we go along.
Exactly. And, you know, some people find comfort in losing themselves in depression, or find comfort in losing themselves in happiness. You know, it really is like, it's honestly, I feel at this point, it's definitely a choice of how you react to all these different elements. And as we say, these elements, these challenges are relentless.
Are you doing the washing up, Gavin?
No. There's someone playing a drum kit just the other side of the room. I'll have to stop.
Right.
No, I'm joking.
So you grew up in London. Am I right in thinking that?
Yes, I am.
That's currently where I'm chatting to you from.
North London.
Whereabouts was home?
Swiss Cottage, exactly where I grew up. And I played football for the Abbey Road. So I was a lot in Kilburn, Quex Road, West Hampstead, bit of Hampstead, bit of Highgate every now and again, but pure North London. So Arsenal, North London.
And you were born in 65, so you would have been 12 years old in 1977 when I think the world changed beyond belief for the better because of a little four-letter word called punk. And everything that came from that has brought so much to my life. And it's such an amazing period in history that fascinates me. Were you old enough to have caught any of that as it was happening? Were you there? Did you go to any gigs?
It's funny because I was just about to post a picture. I don't normally post pictures of my kids, but I do every now and again. I've got this amazing picture of my son who's obsessed with Sex Pistols. And it's just amazing to me because, as you say, I was 12 at the time. I lived down the road. There was a record shop called Manzi's on Finchley Road. I've got Corona.
It's all right. I think we're socially distanced enough. I'm not going to catch it.
I worry about yourself already. So basically, I grew up right next to, within walking distance to a record shop. And what they would do, are you fucking kidding me? What they would do is, let me get rid of this.
No worries, mate.
They do these soft calls, insurance. I spent my pocket money on that. And so exactly that whole thing you're talking about, it was a revolution. There'd be nothing like that again. And the outrage you felt in society, and like my older sister, she was a punk, so she had all the kind of, 15 to 19 years old. They were all in bands. Everyone's in squats. There was like just a whole world of people.
So you were exposed to all of that from early age.
I was a token 12-year-old with like spiky hair, even though my hair was a bit curly, but with the egg white, we used to make it happen.
My
sister would spike up for me, and I'd sort of have one like bit of safety pin from the lip or in the shirt, and go on the 31 bus down to the King's Road. We'll come down the King's Road, see the Teds and the punks, walk into dictionaries. But I was 12, so at 14 I was down there when Public Image played on the rooftop.
I've had John Lydon on this show. What a force of nature that guy is. He's incredible.
He's incredible, man. I love him.
So you saw them at the peak of their powers.
No, because they never played that day.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? And so as far as actually seeing gigs, I helped my sister's band take the equipment to the shows, whatever pubs in North London, in Highgate, in Finchley, up in, near the Arsenal Archway, all of those pub shows. But I was too young to go in, so I was way outside, like the token kid. And so I don't have the romantic stories of being in the gig, but I have the romantic truth of like being outside, and all my sister's friends would like, grab me off to the side, a couple of years older than me, just like snog me. And like,
amazing.
Like, oh, great.
So you were basically the character that Thomas Turgoose plays in This Is England. You were Sean.
I don't know. I was definitely in it, and it wasn't at the side of me. I was dead center. Thanks to my sister, really, and all the people that she knew. So that exactly shaped my life. I mean, that to me, Sex Pistols, Never Mind the Bollocks, is the most perfect record, most perfect band ever. Like, just a band in one record, even more so than Guns N' Roses.
What's amazing about that album as well is it still sounds fresh and exciting today. Like, it hasn't dated at all lyrically in terms of the guitar tone. Like, everything about it still sounds potent and powerful and like raw.
Yeah, for sure. I was teaching my son how to play Bodies.
Amazing.
Literally 2 days ago, I sat in his room, both of us in, both of us on guitar, sitting there. Topless, because in the morning, just got a pair of shorts each and just jamming. And it was late at night. I was like, listen, I'll do this. And he's really into playing guitar. He just likes punk. So I've been playing in a Gang of Four. Like, he really likes Green Day. I said, well, that's cool, but like this is the Sex Pistols. So now he's in love with the Sex Pistols. Then I played him Gang of Four. I played him Public Image to show him how, you know, if you do punk music now, you've got to take the spirit of it. But everyone's done the pop punk stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Just get out on a limb and like get a bit angular. So I've been playing in Gang of Four because I think that's really good. It's just a bit more intricate, you know? And he's such a natural musician that actually, once you realize, if you can play a little bit, you want to go a little bit beyond the kind of thrash, fast stuff. You know, it's nice to play that as well, but I don't know. Yeah, I was trying to like be like, look, check it out. This is Tool. So I'm playing a bit of Tool and a bit of, you know, more intricate stuff and sort of more classical based rock things, you know, just to kind of open it up. But he's only 14. He's only the beginning. So it's really an incredible thing to be able to connect with him on, because I haven't actually forced it. It's just this natural inquisition that he has for it, which he didn't have like 8 months ago.
That's amazing. I guess that's the age when it happens. For me, it was very much 13, and then 14, bang, you're in it. And it's like girls, music.
Yeah,
that's hopefully not booze and all the rest of it. But, you know, maybe as we all go through, I'm sure. I mean, what happens? So after punk, because obviously punk was kind of over and done before everybody knew it. And then it evolved into, you know, it went into post-punk and goth and new romantic and new wave and all these different strands. Where did you go with your musical path after punk sort of, you know, came and went and moved on and evolved? Where did you go
That's
next with
I
your
really,
taste?
I really got into like more aggressive kind of dance hall, you know, Public Image. So that really Glenn Branca, Cycles of Repetition, kind of bit Per Ubu,
you know,
I really loved that. And that's Per Ubu then led into the Jesus Lizard,
yep,
and the whole underground American scene. And Jane's Addiction.
I've had Perry on the show as well. He's amazing. Amazing character.
Yeah, I saw this one show. That's when I was like 17 or 18, I started to see a few shows. I saw the Chili Peppers when they played once in Hammersmith, and they had Hillel on guitar. You know, that was a long time ago, right?
Yeah.
And I saw Jane's Addiction when they had Eric Avery on bass.
Yep.
At Acklam Hall on in Portobello. And that was like a small club. And that really was the moment where I lost my mind in terms of performance. And that's really, you know, a lot of the time I try and see it. It's really interesting to ask these questions, because the reason why I did a band like Bush is because, first off, the energy of punk, I'd found reborn in Mudhoney. You know, I found it reborn in those bands, Jesus Lizard, Shellac, Rape Man, Big Black, you know, those bands.
Absolutely, yeah. Huskadoo, Replacements.
Huskadoo. You listen to those bands, and I was listening at the same time like the Pixies, Throwing Muses, My Bloody Valentine. You know, these
great
are all
stuff.
Really massive bands for me, because they were rock music. Like, I didn't really connect to like hair metal, Def Leppard, Poison, even Guns N' Roses. I kind of obviously respected them because I could, there's great fucking tunes, but somehow the aesthetic wasn't, you know, David Yao, wasn't all those, you know, that whole American hardcore scene.
Yeah,
I like that. Fugazi, you know, Fugazi, Gang of Four, they're doing this cool rock thing. And then when I saw Perry, I just fell in love with the whole performance side of it. And I think it's probably with Britpop, where I just found it too mannered and too orderly. I just couldn't believe it. Like, everyone treating their guitars like up under their armpits. Like, I want fucking fire and flames. And I want Hendrix, but no one could play like him. So I hate blues guitar. You know, blues guitar rock, fucking nonsense. You know, it's just like, that's why I've been in a rock band for all this time. I never played the blues. I mean, I know that on the first few records with Nigel, his style had a bluesy thing with a slide, but we always kept away from the blues. And whenever anyone solos near me and it sounds a bit bluesy, I'm like, that is going nowhere. Mine's always like weirder, stranger stuff. Like Nigel was really good at that weird shit. Chris is kind of out there from a hardcore background. So there's no ever kind of like bluesy solos with someone like, hey, blow it, man. Let it rip, you know, all that nonsense.
Yeah.
There's none of that. And that's why I've always kept on that side of the tracks. And that's the genesis of the band and how, along with my own flavor, that's always bad. I kept on that side. It's an alternative side. And that's why I fell in love with that music, because it had everything I loved. You know, when you listen to Jesus Lizard, it's got all the guitar and the bass. It's angular guitar and like rolling bass. And that's what really inspired me. And then Perry's performance was just like immense. I mean, like, you go and see Kevin Shields and My Bloody Valentine, that was shoegazing, because everyone was gazing in their shoes, literally. And it's not that interesting to watch in comparison to Perry Farrell, David Yao, you know, these shaman on stage. That's what I've always based my stage stuff on, is to be as wild and shamanic and surprising and angular and weird and, you know, just lost in music. You know, that's why I'm so into playing shows, because I think that's a huge part of it, of our whole aesthetic, is how we perform.
Let me ask you this, Gavin, because it's interesting to me that you got Clive Langer to produce the first album, when at that point his kind of CV was a lot of the stiff record type kind of post-punk, new wave, Dexys Midnight Runners, Madness, Elvis Costello, Morrissey, all that kind of stuff, seems to be quite out of step with all the touch points you're referencing. So how did he come to be the guy to do that first record? And was it a good, positive, productive experience working with him on 16 Stone?
The reason was really simple. I mean, I always go off instinct and simplicity, right? People overthink most things. So I loved Shipbuilding so much.
Oh man, what a song.
So I figured that the guy who wrote that song, the guy had this history of all these hits, and I grew up loving Madness, you know, North London.
Yeah.
I love Madness, right?
I just recently saw them at the Royal Albert Hall, like a couple of months before COVID hit.
Really? And their early records were like, you know, especially that first record.
Yeah, man. Well, they were doing like Bed and Breakfast Man and all those early hits.
It was just the sound of the streets, the sound of where I grew up, you know, where I played football. Everyone was skinheads, everyone was suede heads. Even though I was into punk, Bowie, Roxy's music, and I was the sort of the weird left of center kid. My youth club, I was one of the girls who were punks, you know, and everyone else. All my friends I grew up with were Farrahs, Gabichis, Ford Escorts, remodeling.
Although you were connected to the American underground music, you were still very much a Londoner at heart, and so you were inspired by that.
Well, I just was
subculture.
surrounded by Asbos, and Patrice Russian, and jazz funk, rollerblading with the plimsolls, you know, on your trainers, putting, you know what I mean, like that fucking regular lifestyle, football fans.
Yeah.
That style. Gabichis and Farrahs, that was it. And like, you know, Fred Perry's, it would have moved on from Fred Perry's, you know, and it was all like sort of diamond things. And I just feel like, fucking, I got a couple of those tops. I got one pair of Farrahs, Gabichis. This is fucking bullshit. But Bowie looks so much cooler. So I never dressed like that or thought like that, but that's everyone I grew up with, apart from my school. My school was a whole different thing. So that created the kind of schizophrenia in me. That was really academic. But where I grew up, everyone was just like basically football fans and really multicultural, black and Irish together. That was basically it and me. And so I have all this crazy mixture of stuff, of history in me. And that's what makes it interesting. You know, that's why it's so important to find your own voice, because each of us, we have our own voices and our own kind of genesis and genealogy, and that's what makes everyone so interesting. So I love the performance and the energy from punk, so I like, that's why I like the American sound. So Shipbuilding I loved, and I went to meet him in the pub in Camden. And
Do you remember?
It's the one that was on, it's on Archway. If you go down from Primrose Hill, so I can't remember what the pub's called. It's actually gone now.
Oh, like it has gone, is it?
Home.
Well, I guess probably they're all gone now as well, aren't they? Yeah.
It's the Asian home. So, and I liked him, and I thought we were American enough. And that's the point of it. I just figured, like, look, fuck, we got, everyone's going to think we're American anyway. Because that was the sound we had.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought Clive was the only hope. Where'd you bring him around? It turned out it made no difference whatsoever because everyone thought we had a grunge, for want of a better word. I mean, Come Down is not a grunge song. That's a freaking Billy Cobham bass line. So it's nonsense. But we did have some grunge elements in there, 100%, and the performance was really grunge-related. And it was exciting. That was the time, and that's how it all came about. So it's interesting how you have all these things, all these factors that make us who we are. It's not just one thing. It's very Malcolm Gladwell. It's very like Blink. If you read it.
Is that your dog?
Yeah, that's mine. That's my cat, actually.
What you're feeding it. It's interesting.
Too much,
you know, were you 30 or almost 30 when 16 Stone came out as well? Were you 29?
Something a little bit later, yeah. 26, 27 when we signed. Yeah, it was very late. Everything was very late.
Did you feel like you were a little bit older and wiser and ready for, I mean, does anything prepare you? Because obviously
the album just exploded, didn't it? The funny thing about it is that I felt really like there was a sense of I'd failed for so long and been around for so long that I was worried that I would get removed before I'd have a chance to have a shot. I mean, a sort of a panic that wasn't really allowed to feel like that and that to happen. So to me, it was just that self-torture that goes with being an artist. I just tortured myself about it. As daft as a date was, and nothing to do with my fault, as dumb as it was, I tortured myself with like, well, it's going to be taken away from you any minute anyway. Fucking lucky you got in the building, mate.
Yeah.
And that was a weird thing, you know, and it's one weird when you look back on your own life and you realize that, I mean, from my own point of view, you know, I have this punitive superego. That's the psychiatric analysis of my personality, which means that I'm always going to beat myself up. So I took that as a way of, what was I ever doing? I mean, imagine I just never gave up. I just continued to work and was always like the sort of the black sheep. That's why I probably never got signed in England. It's been around a bit too much and people didn't really know what to make of me. And I kept on, I've basically been trying to write the same rock song ever since I began writing songs. So it's not like I really changed. But it was funny how I had to come to America to get the record deal. I was like 27, 26, 27. And that's like, you know, you start to feel like, oh, it's like a girl who feels like, you know, she's gone past marrying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's this kind of trend,
like,
isn't there, in the music industry?
I'm going past the career age. You know, people are like, look, he's only 17. It's like, I mean, I did get signed really fast when I began writing songs. Like 6 months after I began writing songs, I signed to Warner Chappell for £5,000. And then when I, you know, then years later, 7-8 years later, I had to pay, I don't know, $340,000 to Warner's to buy myself out of the contract.
Wow. Like,
yeah. Fuck.
That's not an uncommon story either, is it?
Well, what's uncommon is they actually let me do it. That was what's incredible because my publishing was worth a lot more than that. And I was signed to them. Stupid. I don't even know how I did a deal that was like, I mean, you'd get out of it now and I'd be able to sue them forever because that was like slave labor. But it literally 7 or 8 years and they apparently hadn't paid back the $5,000 or something.
Did you move out to America pretty soon after the release of 16 Stone?
No,
or did
no,
you stay in England
no.
for a while?
I stayed in England forever. I only moved to America when I had a baby.
Right, right.
My first son here. And obviously at that point, initially, the plan always in my life with Gwen was that we would live in London. I was like, I'm not leaving London. LA is a graveyard for musicians. Are you kidding me? Like, people would die. No. And then, as soon as she started to, you know, go to doctor's visits and this and that, it was obvious that she wanted something there. You know, English people want English care, and Americans want American care. It's just natural. So that was it. So I never thought about it really ever since. I just summed it here because of them. And most of the things in my life are to do with them and through the prism of all of my children. You know? I'm a good dad.
How's it been in lockdown? Have you been with your kids? Have they been with their mum?
Yeah, they began it with me and then they went away for 2 months because had the opportunity to go somewhere away to a, you know, a secluded place. And I didn't know at that point when it first began, we thought,
oh yeah, it'd be a couple of weeks and then
looking at, you know, and it just seemed, well, it was more that you, it was terrifying. Was it going to be just like in the air and were they all going to get it? And I was like, well, they're better off. So they went away for a little bit. So I had a weird time being here on my own with a few friends that had quarantine coming in and out, but generally I was on my own. And so that was pretty wild.
Yeah.
And then,
I've been in a similar boat, sort of 3 months of solitude. It's a trip.
Yeah. 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 I mean, as I say, you know, it's like there was the economic, well, there's the health impact that was killing people and, literally, and the, economic devastation, you know, people losing their businesses, their jobs, they can't eat, they can't, you know, this and that. So if you had enough money for sandwiches and you weren't sick, you'd have to shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Dying to shut your mouth and stay home and shut your mouth again. That's it. And like, I couldn't get it. People complaining, I'm bored. It's like, just be grateful that you're, you know, not, if you're not in those categories, and, how can you be bored? I mean, all you need is a phone.
Yeah, I don't think anybody could ever be bored in today's world. Like, there's every song ever written at the touch of a button. You know, you can get any movie ever made just by renting it. Books still, you remember those things? I've actually written a book during lockdown, Gavin. That's what I've been up to. Use the time wisely.
Nice.
And
that's impressive.
I was listening to an interview of you. You studied literature at college or university, right? You were a literature student?
My A levels were English, French, and Spanish, and I learned the language, and I read the literature. So what I got was a really beautiful start with English literature, French, and Spanish, and that, you know, having those three powerhouse histories as in, you know, for information was really, I don't know. I mean, it's no disconnect that I'm obsessed with words.
Yeah.
I do love to read. I, you know, I'm reading all the time. Different speeds at different times, you know. But there's always something.
Does
on
literature
the go.
Influence you as a lyricist? The writers influence you as a songwriter?
Of course, the whole time. I mean, nothing but. You know, I read. We need people's, you know, articulation and for people to be succinct and clear and precise and concise. And the more they are like that, the better the use of the word, the more intriguing and the more informative. I mean, look, you know, I've got a song on the new record called Words Not Impediments. And we're at a time where communication is key. Communication is everything.
Yep.
Yeah.
In terms of specific writers or books, are there any that stand out that really shaped you early on, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, there's people like Allen Ginsberg, Charles Bukowski.
Oh, yeah, classics.
Paul Auster, E.E. Cummings, Rainer Maria Rilke. You know, these people just, they write in certain ways. But I can read a Balzac book and just be like, take it away. It's like watching the most gorgeous French film of life, you know. Just
You
just read that and it. And I really mean it in a non-pretentious way because I don't like it when it's so kind of like erudite and, you know, I mean, you know, journeys for people to read and identify and enjoy. And just basically a high-class use of time.
Balzac's buried in the same cemetery as Jim Morrison, I think, in Paris. I remember going to see the Jim Morrison.
Père Lachaise.
Yeah.
Père Lachaise.
That's the one, yeah. I remember going there before they had the armed guards. Now I think they have like round-the-clock armed guards because people were just going to Jim Morrison's grave and I think just partying literally on it. And so I think it's a bit more regulated and secure now. But when I went, you could just sort of go up and put a, you know, a guitar plectrum on it or whatever you wanted to do. And Oscar Wilde's in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's no joke. If you're going to die, that's the place to be.
Let me ask you about some of your Hollywood experiences, if that's all right, Gavin. I was watching the other night. I forgot you were in it. The first cameo in it, this is weird, Zoolander. And there's the big scene where there's the big fashion launch event. And the first cameo in that movie is Donald Trump. And I can't remember whether you remember that he's in there or not, but he is. He's the first one talking.
I've done like seven movies now. I've just shot one that's receiving a lot of backlash because Paris Hilton Jackson is playing Jesus.
Right.
And that's called Habit, and that's getting a lot of attention right now. 250,000 signatures according to BAMIT, the Catholics. Now, I'm wondering whether the same 250,000 people signed any petitions about the priests and the their issues with paying people off for sexual abuse claims. Now, yeah. I wonder if the same people are signing those, the same one or different Catholics, different sect. So I'd love it. So Zooland is bullshit. Like I sat there as the camera went past me. I did not have any acting, any lines.
No, there's no dialoguer in there. But I mean, what was the energy like on that set though? It must have been a fun set to be on for that day.
It was all right. I remember going there with Gwen. It was a bit chaotic. I remember going there and not knowing where to go, wandering around a bit. Then we found someone, you know, the third AD. They put us in a trailer and no one was that friendly. And then we sort of walked on and did the scene and sat in the rafters. And then there was only two shots of Gwen, one shot of me, which is, you know, very ladylike. You know, it should be the way, ladies first. And she's very beautiful. So that was it. And I left. So I don't really, I definitely do not count that for me. That would be me really desperate to be in the claim I was in there, literally. But the other ones, you know.
Well, no, you've done some legit acting as well. Obviously, Constantine, you've got loads of amazing, intense scenes with Keanu in that. I mean, what was it like working with him? Because at that point, obviously, he's probably one of the biggest, well, still is now, but particularly then, one of the biggest action movie stars in the world, especially that brand of supernatural action films like Devil's Advocate and The Matrix. Like, he's just the king of that little subgenre. What's your memories of working with him on that film?
Really generous. I mean, you know, as an actor, really, you crave, you need generous actors to work, to act with, to work off of. And you tell people's generosity by the passion they put into the shots when they're off camera, you know?
Yeah.
That's the one, that's the big moment, the big tell for me is, are they going to, what are they going to be like? And he was really generous, and Jaimin Hunt Sue's in that as well. And it just was a great energy. And for me, I did drive to that set surmising that I was definitely 100% the most inexperienced person on that set. The janitor experience on that movie. It was a $100 million movie, and I was just showing up like fucking...
Let's get to work.
Just like chanting... Just like bluffing, just like the poker guy. Look, here comes poker. Here comes poker. Because I'd never really done an ensemble piece that I did do a thing, but I was like, nah, you're the most inexperienced on this set. So just hit the ground running. So I did, and I loved it.
I have to ask then, how did you land the role? How did you manage to find yourself in a room with all these like titans of acting and on this insane big budget set?
I did I remember going to Santa Monica. I did a reading for someone, and the writer, Akiva Goldsman, wrote my manager and said that I had done the words exactly as he had imagined them, and he just couldn't. He was so thrilled that I brought his words to life like that. Like something like that is really, really complimentary.
Wow.
And you learn and you realize that so much of it is just being the right type.
Yeah.
You know, when people write things and why you get, I mean, I've done loads of auditioning that I didn't get and loads of auditions that I did get. The last two movies I've done, Sofia Coppola, I didn't have to audition for. And this
The
last,
Bling Ring, right?
The Bling Ring I didn't have to audition for. And this last one I just got offered it. So I've got enough work now that people even know if they want me or not. But when I did the Constantine audition, that was a really high compliment. And I've always been amazed I've never done anything else for him. And I know him and I like him and I really, really like him. And I just always like, thought it'd be the beginning of our working relationship, but apparently it was our only working relationship.
Well, maybe it'll come around again. It's interesting. I did a podcast a while back with Stephen Graham, and he said he worked on Gangs in New York with Scorsese in, like, I guess 2002, 2003. And Scorsese said to him at the end of that shoot, "We'll work together again." And he was like, "You know, you don't have to say that if you don't mean it." And he's like, "No, no, we will." And then it wouldn't be until The Irishman, which just came out last year, that they'd revisit that relationship. So maybe it will happen. It isn't the right time just yet. But
I love your attitude.
How was working with Sophia? Because she's a really interesting filmmaker. I love her work.
She's beautiful. She glides. She literally glides across the room. And everyone who works on her stuff looks like a super cool artist from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Everyone's relaxed, like the laziest outfit ever, but really, really amazing. She's wonderful, you know. And again, I really enjoyed that. And I got to work actually with Paris Hilton in that movie.
Yeah.
Now I've worked with Paris Jackson, Paris Hilton, all the greats. Jackson.
It's a really interesting story, isn't it? And period in like American LA history.
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
You did another American. Go on, sorry, mate. What are you going to say?
No. I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, the Bling Ring, especially, was a fantastic story, and this habit with Bella Thorne, who's devastating and gorgeous, sexy, spirited actor, and she's just incredible. I loved playing opposite her.
I want to check out the film. I haven't managed to find it ahead of our chat, but I want to. I wonder if you could tell me about it. This movie you did, it's like an American indie film called How to Rob a Bank. Really interesting cast of characters. You've got Nick Stahl, who plays the yellow bastard in Sin City. You've got Terry Crews, who's just hilarious and everything. You've obviously got Bill, David Carradine from Kill Bill, and then Leo Fitzpatrick from Kids as well, and yourself. What was that film like to work on? And would you recommend checking it out? Should I investigate it and find it?
Yeah, I think I saw one cut of it early on, and I didn't think it had worked. I really enjoyed it. I went from Constantine to a $100 million movie to a $1 million movie, where I had much more work, and you shoot far, far quicker.
Yeah.
And you know, there's no time to mess up. You've got to know your lines and take, you know, cut and move on. And Andrew, the director, he just recently actually passed away. It's very sad. Yeah, he wanted to work with me on every movie. He's like, "I want you in all my films." Then he OD'd. So it was a great experience. I need to see it again. I needed some time away from it. So I don't know. I saw something the other night and they were talking about it. And I was like, "Yeah, I don't know if it worked." And he's a friend of his. He goes, "Yeah, I don't think it worked." He got double confirmed. Didn't work. But to me, they're all just like moments in time. And to be in a film, you're just part of it. And you can't have, I mean, with more, my records, I have more control over. But being in a film, you know, it's like I'm just a really small part of it. It's a very big thing. So if the whole thing didn't work, it's not my fault. And if it works, I'm happy to be part of it. You know, Constantine's a great film. It's a bit confusing. And I think if it was a bit less confusing, it would have had sequels and we would be on, like, you know, Constantine 5. You know, that's what I was like. I said to Keanu in New York when saw John Wick, I was like, why the fuck is that they didn't make Constantine? And he goes, "Didn't make enough money." I was like, "Oh, no." He said, "Sometimes you can't ask. Why can't we do that?" It wasn't successful enough. But everyone seems to love that. It was like a cult hit movie.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
What about the, I want to ask you about Woodstock 99. One of those iconic moments in live music history. Who was on the bill the same day as Bush that year? Do you remember?
Limp Bizkit.
Well, okay, right. So it was Carnage. Was that the crazy day?
Yeah, that was. It was kind of incredible, and I hadn't really heard of it because we've been away making this record. And we came back, flew in for this show, and there was this band. So, you know, Korn played, the Chili Peppers. We, our day event schedule. Yeah. Wow, it was really incredible. Really incredible. Chemical Brothers played. We played on that. I think we played on the Sunday. Yeah, Muse played.
What so, about?
Anyway, yeah, what experience?
Is that one that stands out as one of those, you know, legendary moments in time? Because it's weird when you have all of these bands that are all powerful in this one place at this one point in time. I don't feel like these events that we have now, obviously currently there aren't any, obviously, but I really feel like, without being too overly sentimental or nostalgic, I feel like there was a point in time when these kind of iconic events became lesser and fewer and further in between.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the nature of streaming, the knock-on effect of streaming, and the fact that people feel like they have, they financially have to tour more, floods the market more. Other promoters see the festivals working. They promote festivals. People enjoy festivals. So it used to be a bit more specialized and a bit more. Now there's so many festivals all the time. It's like endless festivals because people love them. So, but I would say that each one you play, and I've played a lot of them, like, I don't play any of them differently. Like, I was, when I walked onto the stage at Woodstock, it did take my breath away. 250,000 people in front, and the stage was really massive because I love the perversion of never looking outside, never looking at the crowd, and just being backstage. And then when you come on stage, you get that rush of seeing the crowd. I love that. So I did that with air, and as I went on, I was like, was that a good idea tonight? I don't know. Shit.
Information overload.
I think I'd been living in Ireland by then. I was like just a bit secluded. And so I really went from famine to feast, people-wise. And it was a beautiful night and great memories and, you know, great to be part of something so iconic.
You've worked with some amazing people over the years, mate. And just a couple of producers which stand out. We'll go to Steve Albini first. Obviously, you made that record in Abbey Road as well. I mean, as somebody who grew up listening to these, you know, noisy, industrial, angular, underground American punk bands, which Steve Albini would have, you know, worked on a lot of those records, to be with him and in Abbey Road, what kind of an amazing trip was that? Does it stand out as a happy experience, or how was it making Razorblade Suitcase?
It was incredible. You know, we found ourselves off the first record success, the first record, and, you know, we're on top of the world, and I met him in I really love the sound of the PJ Harvey Rid of Me record.
Yeah.
I really loved Surf Rosa, which is a Pixies record of choice for me, Where Is My Mind. So again, I only need, as I said to you about Clive and shipbuilding and meeting him, I only need two factors. And I thought that we've been playing live so much. That's what separated us from, especially now, from even further from Britpop, was the incendiary nature of the live show. It just seemed that a Britpop goes so orderly and mannered that I just wanted to roll around in the dirt and the dust and you know, get really abrasive. And the Jesus Lives that I love so much, and the PJ Harvey record I love so much, we were going for lunch with Steve Albini in Greektown in Chicago with him and Heather. And he wrote a letter to my manager saying, whilst he's gotten so used to all different types of people over the years, he's immune. His girlfriend, Heather, has an amazing bullshit detector. And what she felt about Gavin is that he is really genuine about what he's doing and the music he wants to make. And so for that reason, I'd be delighted to make a record with Bush for their upcoming record.
Wow.
And it was an amazing letter, which my manager still has. And
I was going to say, do you still have it? I hope so.
Yeah, no, it's my main wrote to my manager. And I always loved that letter. And we had an amazing experience with him. It began at Hook End, actually. We did in the countryside, and there was a problem with his visa and some issue. So we began down there, and then we had to reconvene, and we changed it. We changed it to London. We did the Abbey Road, Studio 2. And it was just incredible because everything was pretty much live. And when I listened to that record, it's a bit, there's elements of it a bit bloated for me here and there. Like, I just would edit certain pieces, but it lives and breathes. It was really about the fact that we stretched every song on our first record to fit the arenas that we were playing and the time slots we had, which got longer. So we got a little bit excessive, a little bit bloated, but it was just, you know, so abrasive. And when the band's on I love it for that. You know, it's just, it's really brave. And I probably would have been more successful if I'd made another one like 16 Stone and Gone Back with Clive, which is what we did the record after. Cause then I wanted to make a more of a hi-fi record and a bit more England to it. So I worked with Tom Elmhurst as a programmer who went on to mix Adele and, you know, Grammy award winning, all this stuff, really amazing career that Tom's had. Amy Winehouse, and he did the more futuristic stuff in one studio, and then Clive Langer was in the other studio doing more band stuff. Going to be, I don't know what we're doing, and we're doing sort of, you know, more and more blows arriving, and he's going, I don't know what's happening. Like, you know, living the dream,
the good old days.
Yeah,
saw you guys live on that tour, the Science of Things tour. Probably like early 2000, like January 2000, at the Wolverhampton Civic Hall. I'm from Birmingham originally, so I saw you in Wolves, and I remember that show being like chaos. I think it was only my second ever gig, and I just remember, like, you know, mosh pits and stage diving. That was my first experience and introduction to a lot of that stuff.
Yeah,
and I was like, wow, fucking rock and roll is awesome.
yeah, I love that. That's big for me.
When Bush called time in 2002, what was the reasons why? And then we'll get to the reasons why you then reformed later on as well. But how come you originally decided to hang up the boots in 2002?
I didn't. There's no hanging up the boots. I wanted to do a side record. I was all impressed by the bands that were on Maverick, or whether it was like the Deftones and Chino with his side Team Sleep. I just liked all these bands that did these side projects, and I thought, what a fun thing to do a quick side project. But I was on Interscope, and so that side project took 3 years.
So that was the Institute record, yeah.
So the Institute record, which was fucking really great and a great experience, and Paige Hamilton, and it was really fun. And it's a shame because it should have been a Bush record, because I missed those songs, because I really want to play those songs every now and again, you know. But I still can, I suppose. And then when I came back, you know, Nigel wanted to, he wanted a bit of time off. He'd missed one of his kids growing up, his first kid, which I now do understand. But at the time I was like, all right, well, I'll do this record. And then they didn't want to reform, and I did my solo record. And really the truth is I should have done Bush right instead of my solo record. But so it just went from a side project to my solo record. And that was the time off, when it means I never stopped working. I never really stopped touring. And well, I didn't tour for a bit because I was making a solo record. And then after that, I just went back to doing Bush, because when I did the solo record and had a massive hit, it just still was too much about, it was still about wanting to do this. People would be like, you know, go on, play everything's in. But no, you know.
Bob Rock did your solo album, right?
Yeah. And then he did the next Bush record.
Oh, wow. And again, what an icon of production. So many amazing records. What was the album or two of his that he'd done that made you want to work with him?
Any of the Metallica records, really, is what I was really coming from, you know. And obviously he did 5 records with them. So I just thought that I wanted to be in business with someone who... In business, I'm going to use that phrase.
In bed with. Like,
yeah, well, he's very well dressed, but you know, he's not my type. I love Bob. I just knew I could learn stuff from him, and he's really cool, and I loved him. And so I go off of, like, you know, he has to have the history and the kind of provenance, and he's had made monster millions, you know, selling albums.
Yeah.
But I really liked him, and so I've been really lucky. Same with Dave Sardi, you know, you meet these people, and you just want to make records with them, and you learn from them, and you see how they operate and what they do. And so it's just been part of my journey, really. Really lucky. I have worked, as you say, I have worked with, like, some devastatingly good people, which is another trick to longevity. Just
yes.
Surround yourself with really good people.
That's, and Josh Freese drummed on that record as well, and he's just like, he's the guy, isn't he? He's amazing.
Yeah, he did my Institute record, he did my solo record, and he did my some other Bush tracks sometimes, actually.
Is Shirley Manson a good pal of yours? I love her. I think she's such a
cool person. I don't know if I lost her in the divorce fire. You know, you get divorced, you're a bit of a fire, and I don't know whether I lost her.
Everybody has to pick a side, right, of husband or wife.
Well, they actually don't, but some people
in ignorant
ways do, and I sort of can't help but think that might be the case. But I'm sure if I saw her again, it'd be good. But we've always been great pals, and I always got along with her. So I hope so. I love and respect her a lot, and she was fantastic on the record.
Were you friends with Chester Bennington? I know you sung on the Linkin Park Memorial concert event, which was amazing. I got to see some of that online.
I mean more of a, I would call it a professional acquaintance, you know.
Yeah.
Full of courtesy and respect, and if I'd see him or when I'd see him, it would be, you know, 25 minute conversation minimum, you know what I mean? Chat, yeah. Shoot the breeze, just a good few times, enough times. I mean, it's what's so weird, isn't it, about death, you want to, you know, you wish you could get more time back with everyone, more people, you know.
You obviously come from an era where there's so many casualties, whether it's drugs or suicide or, you know, alcohol. What do you think it was about that 90s period in music? There's just a real dark cloud over so many of these incredible artists and amazing bands, and such sad stories for so many individuals.
I think that music is a refuge for really broken people, and I think the more broken the better. I think it's a really tough ask, but the closer you live to the flame, the more interesting you are, you know.
Yep.
And I think that of all the crutches that we use, I think that when you get into heroin, and now I suppose opiates of any kind like that,
yeah,
you've left behind the Neil Young, you know, smoke a joint before you write a song, you know, Ginsberg, I smoke marijuana all the, whenever chance I get, you know, drink a bit, have a laugh, you know, whatever. you've lost it. There's a darkness that comes with that side of it. And so I think truthfully, that's always existed. I mean, look at the problem you have now in this country with fentanyl. I mean, in America with fentanyl.
Yeah.
Suicides and death, not suicides, ODs rather. So drugs is just a huge part of it. I mean, and broken people, let's face it, by far the most interesting, the more vanilla. So the perfect kind of manicured hothouse kid growing up in a perfect environment is going to be like the dullest knife in the drawer, you know? So I think it all goes hand in hand, and I don't think that it's human nature throughout history. I don't think there's any worse time than others. I just think that people hear about it more than other times.
How have you managed to protect yourself mentally over the years from the wreckage?
I haven't. So that's what makes it. That's what gives it. That's what gives it, you know? That's what gives it the power.
What's your experience with fame been like, Gavin? That's obviously another form of drug, and it's a very powerful, damaging, crazy, you know, plague. Sometimes it can obviously be beneficial and, you know, can give people a life and a career, but there's a trade-off and a dark side to fame as well, right? And you've obviously been kind of in the eye of that storm in your life. What's your dance with fame been like? What's your experience with that side of your craft?
I try and have a healthy connection to it, in that I see myself at this point in my life as a working musician. And so when I think of fame, I kind of think of Kylie Jenner, or, you know what I mean? That's fame. And when I think of myself, I'm just fully aware that because of the work that I've done and because of my personal life, there's lots of people that know me as well, but I haven't really essential, necessary, obligatory disconnect to it where I can't take myself too seriously. I never expect people to know me. It's a really big world. And I sold 20 million albums, and I have, like, whatever it is, you know, people that check out what we do. So there's 7 billion people in the world. That means, by definition, there's a lot more people that don't know who the fuck I am by a million miles. And so I totally appreciate that and respect that. And I don't, it doesn't stress me. And when I go out on the stage and people do know me, it kind of fills me with joy, because they know me in a festival capacity. If they get crazy in a festival capacity, it really is truthfully because they really like the sound. And they, you know, all right, there's the kind of whole tabloid stuff that goes with me. But, you know, it's a sound, it's a life, and it's something I've given my whole life to, and that I share with my band family and crew family, road family. And it's the payoff for us all. They all work, you know, when we, you know, pre-corona life and post-corona life on the road. And so that kind of adulation and that people knowing you and that kind of fame, that's electric and oh my God, and just magnetic, and you just want to, like, never let go of it. You want to hold it like the comfort pillow of life.
I love it. And I guess humility and gratitude and perspective, all these things play a,
that's what I mean, like,
a big
that's
role.
Why, you know, when that fucking daft thing of people, like, you know, the when you hear people say we're the best band in the world, we're the biggest band in the world, like, I never thought like that. I was like, I know I'm not. But I'll tell you what I am going to do is be a devastating version of myself. You know, I push myself to the limit. Whatever we do, we bring out, execute on a stage, in a comment, in an interview, everything is just going to be the best part of ourselves, you know, putting our best foot forward. And, like, that's all you can do in life. You do that in life, you can have, like, a really relaxed evening. You can be, like, really chilled out, going, no, you can't do any better than the best you can do. And that's all we try and do, all of us, you know.
As we approach the end of the chat, mate, this has been an absolute delight. Thank you for taking the time to do it, and I hope it's been all right for you as well. Do you find that being a Brit and being British and from the backgrounds that we, just the larger, broader cultural backgrounds that we all share as Brits, do you find it kind of allows you to not get as bogged down in some of the the fame game, Hollywood stuff? Because I've noticed there's often a key difference between American artists and musicians and Brits. Brits just seem to have that kind of self-deprecating humour and the bullshit detector, and there's this kind of like just brush it off and crack on with it attitude.
Yeah, I think that we just like, you know, being English and part of our culture is we people are transparent to us, you know, quite good at reading people. And like, you just can't be too flash. And, you know, the most impressive people I've ever met in my life, someone like Tom Waits or David Bowie.
Have you met Tom Waits?
Yeah,
I have. What's he like?
That is incredible. I mean, listen, I grilled him for 40 minutes, poor fucker. I wouldn't put him down. I just thought, what is this?
You've got it though, haven't you? If you get that chance.
I did. I was not tongue-tied. I just grilled him. Grilled him senseless about how he wrote, what it was like, experiences, everything. I thought, you know what? He is not leaving this dressing room. And I'm like, he came into our dressing room in San Francisco once with his children. His son wanted to be a drummer, so he met the drummer. And I just, that was it. I was like, he's my messiah. So I had to just like sit at the foot of his intellect and ask him, of his imagination, and just be like, what is happening? How do you write like that? How can I get anywhere close to you? What's going on? You know? And what came with him was immense humility and just, you know, not defensive. And, you know, when I've met the kind of the fair to middling people who sort of like, just kind of, you know, riding on the wave of average. They're the most sort of stuck up, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's disarming when people are just, you have nothing to prove. Like, fuck you, I've got nothing to prove. It's like, you know, like, I A, B, and C. You can either listen to A, B, and C or not. It makes no difference to me. Thanks for coming. You know, that's it.
I imagine David Bowie was a lot like that as well. Just...
He was interesting and funny and just, you know, great sense of humor.
What a life, mate. It's been all right, isn't it?
Yeah. It's all right. You know what? that's why I just keep my mouth shut unless I'm singing.
And tell us about the new records. This is kind of, this is probably the heaviest stuff you've put out in a while, that's safe to say, right?
Yeah, this is, you know, this needed it. The world needed it. I needed it. The Kingdom is a place for like-minded individuals, free of all the bigotry and racism and homophobia and just self-righteousness. It was around a few people that were causing me a lot of damage just at the end of writing the record, and I just hate them so hard. And then I stopped hating them because hate is really like, it's heavy to carry around. Mm-hmm. But I just was like, I realized what I hated was the kind of self-righteous judgment. That again, goes back to that fame thing. And, you know, everyone gets really judged and everyone knows how to do it best and everyone's fucking perfect and you're not. And so I imagined this place, this sort of like Willy Wonka, chocolate for the mind.
Love
you know?
It. Yeah, yeah. What a movie. I love that.
And that's the Kingdom. And so the record's in there. That's the record's got it.
And tell me, did you work with Tyler Bates on this?
Yeah, I work with Tyler.
I love that guy's just stamp on culture from the soundtrack stuff to the Guardians of the Galaxy work and his stuff with Manson. He seems like he's got that Midas touch.
Yes, he's just a great human being. And I had a few lunches with him before we committed both sides to going to the studio and working together. And we wrote four or five songs for the record. And it was a great experience. And I probably would consider 100% writing with him again. And, you know, became really good friends. He lives around the corner, exactly the same age. We've been through similar things, apart from he has $5 billion worth of business to his writing credits, and I don't.
So almost on an equal playing field. Almost.
Almost. Half of that $5 billion.
Gavin, I appreciate your time, man. I've really enjoyed this. And
right.
Take care. Sure. Have a great weekend, my friend, and all the best.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.